It is a discussion about the everlastingly interesting dynamics between men and women, and it is a discussion that is complicated and therefore enriched by the fact that it is an international discussion. The format that our panel has worked out over hours of fascinating give and take over 14 meals, I think, in the last 2 days, will go something like this. Carol and Jim Avery, who of course most of you know as our local experts on Islam this week, having just come back from 3 years in Saudi Arabia and probably returning for some time, will lead off with a dialogue between men and women as on a number of topics, as it may take place in the world of Islam. And then Ingrid Christensen and Craig Setlich will respond briefly in an attempt to do what is often so difficult to do, and that is to translate from one culture to another. One form of our arrogance, it seems to me, spiritual and intellectual and all other kinds, is our seemingly endless capacity to impose our categories of understanding and our own very limited experience on the rest of the world. So this is an experiment in intercultural communication that we're going to be trying tonight. All of this introductory stuff with the Averys and with Craig and Ingrid, we'll just take the first part of the hour, and our real goal is to engage in some conversation and give and take around the issues of men and women. Let me get our Islamic visitors.
Good evening. I represent a Saudi man.
And I represent a Saudi woman.
The clothes you see us wearing tonight are the normal, everyday clothes of people in Saudi Arabia. I dress in white.
And I dress in black.
My face is open to sight.
But my face is covered.
When we were children, we played, boys and girls, together.
But we went to school separately.
As a boy, I could do almost anything I wanted to. I was seldom reprimanded.
I was expected to help around the home, to learn the chores, and to act responsibly.
At puberty, I began to pray with the men, and I began to observe the holy month of Ramadan, of fasting.
I was still expected to stay at home. I was now required to cover with an abaya and an abaya any time I left my home.
As a man, I could go to many universities in Saudi Arabia, or even overseas, or whatever, and whatever I major in, I'm sure to find a job.
I may go to university at a women's college. However, my job opportunities are limited. I may choose to be a teacher, in which case I could teach in a girls' school or a women's university. I may go into medicine and become a doctor with very few possibilities for job opportunities. Or I may go into business and work at such a job as being in a women's bank and working there.
When it came time to be married, we followed the decision of our fathers, who had decided who we were to be married to. As it so happened, we met briefly, but only for the purpose of rejecting. We could only reject what decision had been made.
Not all couples have this choice. Some of them are not allowed to see their future spouse ahead of time and must marry the person that their father chooses for them.
In the home, I do not participate in any housework. I believe it is not the role of the man to do that, and in fact is probably anti-Islamic.
I am in charge of the house, the household. I may do my own housework, or I may have a hired nanny to help me. I'm responsible for caring for the children. Again, I may have help from my nanny. If I choose to find work, then it's up to me still to do the household duties. The work is simply something extra for me.
But you should not misunderstand. I love my children, and I do spend time with them and delight in them. As far as where we live, after we were married, we went and lived in my father's house, as is the custom of most Saudis.
I therefore became part of the harem, which was the family of women, my mother-in-law, my sisters-in-law, and all of their children. And my life from that point on revolved with them in the women's section of their home.
If we go anywhere, I must drive, because women in Saudi Arabia cannot drive. Or if we ride on the bus, I ride in the front of the bus.
The only way I can get out of the house is for my husband to take me, or to have a driver, or to ride at the back of a public bus. Something about John. My husband is always the breadwinner in the family. He's the one that brings home the money. My only wealth, if I don't have a job, is what I've inherited from my own family, the jewelry that I had when I was married, and that is my wealth. I'm free to do with that as I choose. I may invest my money in a women's bank, and my husband has no control over that money.
When I go to pray, I pray in the mosque with other men, and I do that 5 times a day. So I mix with the men of the community.
I, on the other hand, am expected to stay home and pray with the other women. We cover up during prayer, and we do our routine of bowing and praying to Allah.
These are the roles which God has assigned us, the roles that came through Muhammad and in the Quran. We believe they are the roles for men and women, and that we live more peaceably and our society is strong because of it. If these roles are changed because of the evil Western society which enters into our part of the world, we believe that our world will break apart.
Many women are happy with this way of life. They have no choice. It's God's will, and they must do what is written in the Quran.
I'm just going to say a few things that really hit me, both listening to them tonight and listening to them talk in the last couple of days about this. One thing is that we realized as we were talking that there's a real difference between what they said at the end, it's God's will, it's set down in the Quran, and these rules come from God. That kind of clarity and articulation of things, especially them being written down, to me seems almost like a gift. It almost seems helpful. Partly because I want to know my enemy, and it's all very clear there, it's all written down. So that I have something specific to grapple with. And in our culture here, it seems to me that much of the oppression of women is stuff that's subtle and that we have to sort of work so hard at. Or much of the sex roles, not even oppression of women, but the sex roles that men and women are expected to play in our society are things that we grew up with, that we assumed, that we took for granted, and that I don't like. Many of them I don't like. And when I think about them, I don't accept them. But it's so much work, even to figure out where our roots are and what our roots are, that it's work that we have to do every day of our lives, it seems to me. So in a way, it would be nice to have it all set down, an objective. Another interesting reaction I thought was that these days in America we think we're real smart because there are maybe 2 women's banks in the country. You know, women's liberation has succeeded now because we have 2 banks that are all run by women and for women and have women's money in them and stuff. We don't view that as being a bad thing or a second-rate thing, and somehow it's different to have it be a place that you have to go because you can't have your money in a men's bank. So that's just a little reaction I had. I was just amused at the thought of how proud I am that there are a couple of women's banks in this country. And I similarly felt sort of positively toward the notion of a harem because I like spending time with women. And the idea of being banished to spend time with women seems to me like one form of heaven. So... So those are some initial reactions I had, and I trust that you all will continue many other kinds of reactions. But Craig has some thoughts now.
Well, similarly, as I listened and watched, that rules thing struck me too, that even though Islam comes later than either Judaism or Christianity, it has a clarity of rules that is not found in either the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament. And it struck me that while all three religions come out of a patriarchal society, that certainly within the New Testament, within the Christian tradition, the seeds of change are there, if not explicit, then implicit in some of the understandings about the equality of males and females in the eyes of Jesus. Yes, living in a society with that kind of rigidity would at least make it clear whether you were favored by the rules, part of the oppressors, or out of favor and part of the oppressed. That would make it clear. And in our society, as we all know, there's a great deal of flux and change and redefinition going on. And it's that change and that redefinition that I think has caused, has affected both men and women in our society, producing confusion, producing frustration, fear in terms of men and women. I think women are defining and redefining the roles they choose for themselves. And as that has changed what we have grown up with or what we have assumed to be the norm, as those things have changed, it's caused many males to be uncertain and fearful. And when we first talked about this evening, I mentioned that one of the thoughts I had had originally was to do a male issue thing around the thing, the title, It Ain't Scary Anymore. And Ingrid said, it isn't scary to whom? Something like that. And I said, well, I was thinking about men. And I think that's overstating it, of course, but I think that what I'd like to say in response to, as we look at our society, our culture, over against the Islamic one, that ours is characterized by flux, by change. I think Islamic is changing somewhat too, as I understand it, though not as dramatically as ours.
Like dragging their heels.
Yeah, kicking and screaming and all that. But I hope that we hear, one of the things I'd like to hear from the women and the men here tonight is your own personal and emotional response, as well as intellectual, to the redefining of sexual roles in our society. I think it's one in which males are increasingly sharing in the experience of liberation and the growing liberation for women, and that it is not as threatening to many males as it was earlier. It's still a process. We're not through it, certainly, but I see signs that both males and females are moving in a direction that is beneficial to both males and females.
Do you want to say anything, Jim or Carol, in response to
just one thing. I'd like to remind people, some American women who I meet who are very up in arms against the way of the Saudi women and the Saudis in general. And one thing that came to my mind is that it's not very long ago in our past that women were clothed, not their face, but really from head to toe, long sleeves, long dresses. That was less than 100 years ago. They were not expected to work. Their place was also in the home and raising children. Very few of them worked. And so
I just like to beware of not having a haughty attitude towards these people. You know, what kind of a uncivilized way of life is this, when it's been such a short time ago in our past that we lived in much the same way. So I think we've made great strides, and I think that strides are being made by the Saudis, but it's like it's happening in a little bit different time zone. It started at a different time, maybe.
Well, as I said this morning, one of the presentations is that this is the year 1406 in the Islamic calendar. And I think just the fact of that, because that's when their civilization started, really, with the revelations from Muhammad, that gives us a conception of where they are. You know, they've made great technological progress. They're really not in the Middle Ages in terms of their physical resources in the country, but in personal resources and interpersonal resources, I think they've got a long ways to go. They don't see it that way. They, as I said at the end, they see very much that what we're trying to, they want to take the technology of the West, but not the social mores, the values, and of course they focus on the negative values that we have in our culture.
Let's open it up for some comments and questions now.
I think, to me, if this is true, a perfect symbol of that kind of attitude of the Saudis is that they made the manufacturers of Rolls-Royce automobiles change the hood ornament, which is a woman standing with her arms stretched back. They changed it to a woman kneeling.
I hadn't heard that.
Because they didn't want a woman looking so independent on their automobiles. But it seems to me that women in our culture wear a sort of veil, but it's not to hide us from society, but to cloud our own vision. And part of that is our upbringing. As they say, how do you fight an enemy who has outposts in your head? And part of it is because my experience with my friends and relatives has been that when you take down the veil and you start looking at all the ways that your culture tells you that you really aren't that important, you either get very, very angry or very, very depressed. My own sister saw me reading Ms. Magazine, which by feminist standards is a pretty mild magazine, and she identified it as a radical magazine. She said she had to stop reading it because it was making her too angry with her husband.
Now, I think that one of the things I hear that confuses me a bit, and I think that worries me a bit, is that to hear us saying that we're right, you know, we know what mm-hmm. we're doing, mm-hmm. They don't. Mm-hmm. And I look at our society, look at all the divorce problems with families. One of the things that struck me right away after your comments about women is the isolation mm-hmm. that occurs in our society for men.
And for women.
But for men in particular. In the following sense, that I think that all of you, correct me, but all of you have seen women get together and go out for breakfast in the morning and do things on a regular basis where you socialize. That doesn't happen for men very often. And I don't know what it is about our society that creates that kind of situation.
I want to take a reality check here. Does everybody agree with that?
No. Because I know a group of men, they're retired, they get together for mornings for coffee.
Or about men and sports.
And fishing.
Yeah,
fishing.
And bars. I think it depends what.
And sports clubs.
What men do at those times. I know for us, my husband struggles with walking home and say, our childcare things, I'll say, well, he'll say, well, is she supposed to be doing this? I said, oh yeah, I've talked to so-and-so, and I've talked to so-and-so, and she's done that. And he is sad that he misses out on that. And so he has to, like you're saying, he sort of has to push himself to, when he does get together with men, that they move in those directions instead of just more surfacey things or work things or, and I hear what you're saying in that way.
I think the overall reaction though of the group is that you're probably taking the perspective from a Christian standpoint, and therefore you're probably really only taking 40 to 45% of the overall population. That's leaving out at least half or 40% that maybe you and me don't know as they live in the secular world and don't know anything about Christianity. So I'm kind of swaying with this gentleman.
I think that the isolation that many of us men feel is not having had a lot of training in relating intimately. And I think that's one place where women are better trained in our culture.
Perhaps it's specifically male even to think about that as an issue of training, huh?
I'm just thinking about
it. I have a question for Carol and Jim. Isn't it true
John.
That Gandhi...
John. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
New here. Isn't it true that Gandhi said that, that Islam did not specifically say that the woman was to be put down, but rather did speak up for equality? Isn't that,
in the context of 14th or 7th century history, Islam was a radical force for the woman, for oppressed peoples at the time. Slaves and other groups that were very strongly oppressed, limited a man to marrying four wives. Before that, it was an unlimited number, and the treatment of the women was arbitrary. It determined that women should be treated equally, and men should treat all wives equally. So, yes, it was a radical force at that time, and that was part of what Muhammad was fighting against, those values. Muslims today would argue that they hold women in high esteem. Of course, they have a whole different conception of what a man is. They see them as not equal right up from the beginning. We're not equal. We're essentially different. We don't have the same gifts, and so on. And so part of that is that they hold it part of man's role and God, and part of their responsibility, and they feel it strongly, is to protect the woman. And so in their sense of it, then they see that Islam is very positive, radical force for the family, for a woman. From our perspective, it doesn't appear that way.
Gloria?
That last statement that it's a given because it's written in the Quran, therefore there's no choice, there's nothing to talk about it. Seems to me that isn't all that different from some of the fundamental churches in the United States who say, it says right here in the Bible that subservient to the spouse, to the husband, etc. And therefore, we are, it's not that different. Some do say it's written in our Bible.
That's true.
Well, this is something that I've discovered by being in the Middle East, is how similar fundamentalist groups are and how some of their aims seem to just be remarkably similar. Their limit of discussion, their certainty of decision, and it's scary. And there are corollaries, and not only in Islam, but in the Hindu groups, in Judaism, and so on. If you read the books like of Chaim Potok of the Jews in New York City, definite roles, things are decided, comes from God. We have no choice. To work against it is to deny your faith.
I'm curious from either John or Carol about the interpretation of the Quran. Are there more liberal ways or progressive ways that for which it can be interpreted, or which people are beginning to think it can be interpreted?
Yes. Absolutely.
The fundamentalist view from the Christian faith has certainly been overcome by many, many people, and now seen as a misinterpretation. The Bible was never intended to be interpreted that way. Are there possibilities of looking at the Quran that way?
Well, Well, definitely, just, and you can see that in looking at other Arab countries, which are very Muslim countries, do not follow the same strict procedures as Saudi Arabia. In Turkey, women are not veiled.
It's against the law in Turkey to be veiled.
That's right. Alcohol is a...
That was determined by a man named Ataturk at the beginning of the century, who said, my country is backward. We're getting rid of the fez, we're getting rid of this blasted veil, and we're going to walk into the 20th century.
But was that seen as an Islam position?
Not by other Islamic countries.
Is that progressive?
But there is room for that in Islam. The Saudis don't think so, or at least the conservative ones don't.
Tomorrow I'm going to talk about Muslim women and go into exactly what the Quran says. And it's very vague what the Quran says about veiling and about covering up. The Quran talks specifically about the Prophet Muhammad's wives and that they are to do this. And it's more that the women want to model themselves after the perfect wives of the perfect prophet, that they do it. It does say something about covering with a cloak when meeting a stranger or something.
When you go abroad.
When you go abroad.
Dress modestly, something right. like that.
But it does not specifically say you shall have your face covered all the time.
I wonder I'm wondering whether what I said earlier about it not being written down in this country is correct. And I wonder it sounds like the Quran determines so much of what people think there. And here, our sex roles, our appropriate behavior, our acceptable behavior is dictated to us by magazines, media, TV, you know, what's right, how it's right for us to dress and talk and act. Through some of us, through our religion, through our faith, and obviously, as Gloria pointed out, that's real widely varying in the way it's interpreted, everything from wives be subservient to your husbands to human beings are human beings and all created equal in the eyes of God. And then through our laws, the actual legal structure that we've inherited through the years, many of which are discriminatory against women, in effect or in actual articulation and statement. So if we don't have the Quran, we have these other three areas, all of which are powerful in our lives, and all of which do articulate and write down in black and white ways in which women and men should act differently, should, you know, obey certain laws, which make them different.
The difference is that the Quran stays the same. Ours changes.
Our laws don't change fast, though.
Our son is 14, and his English teacher brought him some Saturday evening posts from the 50s, and he was just really came home. He was just struck by all these defined roles for women, you know. Mm-hmm. Was shocked. So it, you know, brought home how much it has changed in the last 30 years.
But I wonder how much. You remember the case in New Bedford where a woman was raped in a bar by, I don't even know how many men.
Four.
How many? Four were convicted. And the journalists who went through that town and talked to the people of that town heard tremendous anger against that woman. That she should come out with this charge that disrupted the lives of the men. And the journalists heard comments like, well, she wasn't nice, you know, she smoked. Or what was she doing in the bar in the first place? As if those things justified the rape. But that's not just a single incident. That was a Portuguese-American culture. But I know that still, in rape cases, the defense attorney tries to get as many women on the jury as possible because they're less likely to convict. Because if they believe that this woman didn't actively ask for what happened to her, then they have to believe that it could happen to them. And they would rather put the blame on the woman, still.
What can you tell us about that sort of crime in Saudi Arabia. You mentioned prostitution today, but what about rape? Do you have any idea?
As I said today, crime is virtually non-existent in any sense of the word.
If it does exist, we don't know about it.
There was a case this past year where the oil company of Aramco, which is a huge complex, that apparently a couple women were raped by Saudis, and what was it that happened?
American women were raped.
American women. The husbands were thrown in prison, or were the women? I can't remember now. I think the husbands were, the women were sent out of the country and the husbands were put in prison for a certain amount of time. Because John is responsible for me, that I behave properly. And should I misbehave, this is a nice little piece of blackmail, by the way. Should I misbehave, he's the one that goes into prison.
Love you, dear.
So, but the news is so vague, so censored, so many things happening, you just never hear about it. So it's hard to know exactly.
They deal pretty harshly with with rape. They deal pretty harshly with life, but the rape is seen as a serious crime. And I guess most of you are familiar with the film Death of a Princess, where a Saudi princess was caught in adultery, and it's insisted by a member of the family that she and her lover be beheaded. And this happened, and it just so happened, to the embarrassment of the Saudis, that there was a Western journalist who filmed the actual beheading and then did a documentary on it. And there was pretty serious pressure on the Saudi government against both the British government and our own government to not allow this film to be shown in our countries. It was a British journalist who did. And for a while, I think the BBC was going to back down and not show it in Britain, and the PBS seriously considered not showing it, but eventually did. But I think the, it's just, not dwell on the subject, but just to answer it, it's not always dealt with so severely, but it sometimes can be. It's the same as the old thing about they don't have any crime because they cut off the hands of the thieves. Well, that isn't done very often. It's done a few times during a year in the whole country, and when it's done, it's made publicly known. I don't walk down the street and see people's hands getting cut off day out and day in and day out. It's said in the newspaper when it's going to happen, but it's meant only, I think, for multiple offenders, and it's a serious way of dealing with it.
Carol, just following what you said, were you saying that the two women who were apparently raped were being held responsible for what happened, in which case it was not...
I don't think you're right about
that. I shouldn't say, because like I said, we never get news, we get rumor. Everything we get is rumor. In fact, Aramco has what is called the rumor control, where you can call and say, I've heard such and such, is that fact or is that rumor? So I should not, I probably should not, I shouldn't even have said anything, because by the time it reaches my ears, it's always by word of mouth. And I can't remember exactly. I think, though, that the women were just sent out of the country and the men were...
Well, they probably would have been anyway, but I think the men who did the raping were dealt with very severely.
Probably, yes.
Carol, do you know much about the relationships between the women? Is there less competitiveness or anything?
Between the women within a household?
Yeah. Are they really close? Or?
I think so.
I think they generally are really close. I think this, if you get into having more than one wife, there may be a lot of friction there. But I think as far as the wife and the mother-in-law and the sisters-in-law, I think they develop a very strong relationship. And they all tend each other's children, and so I think there's quite a strong community spirit there.
The relationships in that way are very divided. I think men only deal with men as far as their emotional needs go. Men hold hands in Saudi Arabia when they're walking down the street. Never a man and a woman hold hands. I asked one of my students once what he was doing for the weekend. He said, oh, I'm going to Bahrain. And I said, oh, you're taking your family. Just my automatic response.
And he looked at me, so I come from another planet. And he said, no, I'm going with some of my friends. And it's very sad, I think, that I think marriages, my perception is that marriages are very shallow. An example is a friend of ours, a couple that we know, have broken the barrier and gotten to know Saudis, and one of the main reasons is they speak Arabic, and they spoke it before they came to Arabia. And they went camping with this family, the extended family. And the whole day, the men and the women spent it separately. The men did things like go out and tend camels. They kind of do that as a hobby now. and the women did women's things, took care of the children and did the cooking and all of that. But Steve and Betsy wanted to see each other during the day. I mean, because by the time the kids were put to bed and everything, they were both exhausted and just wanted to sleep. I mean, they spent the evening together, but there was no time to really relate to one another. So they set a time apart every day that they would go privately for a walk in the sand dunes. And the women really got curious about this, wondered what in the world was going on. I mean, and they said to Betsy, what do you talk about? They just had, does he want sex? I mean, that was their only conception of what there was to do between a man and a woman in the middle of the day. It's just like there was nothing else, and that struck me as such a sad statement.
What about men and men? Is there more intimacy among
men? Yeah.
And what's the flavor of intimacy?
When they meet with one another, as I said, they hold hands. Just physically, you can see it. They kiss each other on the cheek or on the side of the nose, and they're very intimate and warmly so.
What's the flavor of the intimacy? I mean, how deeply, I know intimacy, I know the kind of intimacy I have with some of my women friends, and I know mm-hmm. the kind of intimacy I have with my husband, but I'm wondering what kind of intimacy the Saudi men have. I mean, do they bear each other's soul with one another?
No,
is it a gentle intimacy? Is it a sparring kind of intimacy? What do they do?
I wouldn't know enough to answer that. I know the student, my students get very close to one another. I mean, like all students do, and gripe about their teachers. But
does it seem to have a gentle touch to it?
Yeah, I get that.
Sounds that way.
There must be that. My only response is that, you know, as a human being, there must be a need for that, and they must find it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they must find it with one another. Mm-hmm. I haven't been inside one of those relationships. It's really difficult to break those barriers. For one thing, we are told not to get close to our students, and that's a really hard thing. I love teaching, and I love one of the reasons I love teaching foreign students is because I get to learn so much about them. But one of the hardest things for me as a foreign language teacher is that there are certain barriers and subjects that are just off limits, and so it's really hard for me to break down those barriers and get to know my students.
I'm wondering about cultural comparisons in the religious life, people's reactions to that, because it's so interesting to me that men go to the temple. Men can go into religious buildings and places and worship together. Women are expected to have religion, evidently, but they do whatever religious things they do. They pray at home. They have their religious instruction at home. So that there, it's just plain sorted out. And it's very complicated here, as we all know. What do you think about that? Does that sound better than how we struggle? Or?
This brings up the issue to me whether or not there are things that are relative, whether there are absolutes. I was thinking about that because it seems to me that the Christian gospel says that one absolute is male and female are equal. I mean, if we understand Paul in that sense, which many of us here do, that he was wrong and recanted, so to speak, in Galatians. But when we look at Saudi society, for instance, I mean, can we say, as you said, John, that we have to realize that we're looking through our own glasses and see it through our own culture, or can we say this is something that's pan-cultural, that male and female are equal in the eyes of God, and the Saudis are on a path that we cannot embrace?
I just know that so many of my women friends have left formal churches, have stopped going to church because of the sexism in churches, because they find themselves so diminished by going to church in this culture, in this country, in this time, and that going to church is more painful than it's worth. So they pack up their troubles in their old kit bags and go, but they don't worship at home, probably. Maybe. And I just think church attendance in this country is real poor. It's partly because women don't go anymore. When women don't go, they don't bring their families.
It seems sort of ironic to me to hear people in the very beginning when you said it appealed to you to have something down black and white. Because that's the way we used to have it, and we didn't like it.
Yeah.
You know, and so here we are.
There's and only the some limited sense in which it appeals to me.
And the other thing is, I wonder if it's fair to compare a totally closed society that doesn't even allow the name of Christ or Christianity to be mentioned to, or would it be better to compare a culture where either women were put down but the church was allowed to come in and then cause this terrible conflict? I mean, if there's no church in Saudi Arabia, no Christian church, then there really isn't a conflict. And it's hard to compare something that's not allowed to change to our culture that is. Would it be better to compare it to a country like Egypt or somewhere where there is a, you know, they are allowed to at least...
Well, Egypt's going in the opposite direction. They're going from liberal to conservative, unfortunately. But,
well, I don't know about that, but somewhere at least where Christ...
Well, that was part of the dilemma in planning this was to, you know, are there enough cross things between the Saudi culture? I mean, the thing that is always interesting about the Saudi culture is it is shocking. I mean, that things can be so black and white, so different from what we expect. Maybe it's not subtle. Maybe the differences are too vast and not subtle enough. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or, I mean, you're just not allowed to bring in any change. It's understood. It's black and white.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you work in a country where, in some of the third world, where women really have been put down, and then the church comes in and starts preaching we're all equal,
mm-hmm.
then you're really causing... horrible trauma because the whole culture is in upheaval, but they're allowing it. Is that more like our country, is what I'm saying, than something that...
Somebody else answer that question. I don't know the answer.
Elmer, you haven't jumped in yet. Do you want to jump in now?
Well, I'm confused by that question. It seems to me that in this country, the church has been the one that frozen the culture rather than the other way around. And I get more comfortable in implying that it is Christianity alone that has the story of freedom for women.
Well, right.
I think that it is, I think it's human and of the nature of humanity to be about that, and that it is, when it's been messed up, we need whatever corrective there is, and for us that may be Christianity. So I guess I'm a little uncomfortable thinking. You may be right about the closed society, other. I didn't resonate with the Christianity part, because Christianity gets really so often. Well, Marty said it years ago, it's been along about sex and about women almost through its whole life.
Well, I was responding to what this guy said about men and women being equal. Mm-hmm. And God mm-hmm. And surely not everyone assumes that.
Though. They're unequally equal throughout the gospel. That's the problem.
Back here. Go ahead.
I don't know about Trent, but I was in Egypt briefly this year, and we had a Christian guide who explained about their marriage traditions and so on. She said, the Coptic Christian Church is one of the oldest Christian churches in existence, and their traditions are very much like the Islamic traditions, where the parents choose the mate, and they have the option to reject by saying something about the prophet. The proposed groom comes to the house, and the proposed bride serves some coffee, and he doesn't say, or she doesn't, I don't remember exactly how it works, but there's a comment about the coffee rather than about the woman. Anyway, they aren't, I don't believe that the Christian women in Egypt are any farther ahead than the Islamic women in Egypt, just by virtue of their Christianity.
Back over here.
Until very recently, I worked for Johns Hopkins University Press. And while I was there, we got a book order from a Middle Eastern country, Arab country, I don't remember which one. And one of my coworkers called up to find out what was the best way to send material. And whichever source she went to said, well, you'd better check through the books first to see that they'll pass, that they won't be confiscated. And she said, well, these aren't pornographic books. They're Johns Hopkins University publications. And the person she was talking to said, no. You have to see if there are any uncovered women's faces in the books, in pictures like that, because those just won't go through. But then, it seems very backwards, doesn't it? But walking through Holden Village, I see the guys go out on a hot day for a hike on the trails in just shorts. We never even think about that as women. Darn it, why can't I go out in just
shorts? I thought about that.
But I mean, there are many things that are that way in our culture as men or as women that just don't even come up. They're so set, like that way.
Oh, I was going to respond that I think that cultural Christianity has oppressed our women, and I don't think that true Christianity has.
No.
Christianity is redefined in every term. True Christianity is redefined by every
system. Yeah. I think, you know, if you mean by that true Christianity, some absolutely pure understanding of the gospel, I would agree. But if you're talking about real flesh and blood church, I would disagree. Because that, I mean, you know, there's, you can go do wonderful quotes from the church fathers. Many of you have heard of, you know, wonderful Ambrose, who said that the highest purpose of marriage was to produce more virgins. And well, that's what he said. I mean, that use of women and that opinion of women has been through the church's history up until very recently. And that's what, when I said in my remarks before about the kernel or the truth that is in the gospel is there, but it takes, like in so many other areas of life, it's taken the church a long time to hear it or to believe it. And you know, and if women are not worshiping because of the oppression they feel in churches, that is incredibly sad, because it seems to me that the voices of those who are oppressed need to be heard, and I see the church, as well as other aspects of society, responding. Maybe not as fully as they might or as quickly, but they are responding. That gives me reason to be hopeful, but then I'm a male, so I would qualify with that, but I see that happening. I see that changing, and I see the role of women in the church growing in a very positive way in the last generation.
Not in many churches, though. I mean, in many churches it is not growing.
I think in some ways that's the problem, too, because as we get a bit of a taste of freedom, then you realize how oppressed you've been. And when the roles are so defined as they are in Saudi Arabia or in a fundamentalist church, sometimes that's really easy to accept. You know where you are. You don't have to struggle to figure out where it is. And when you start to see that struggle, then it becomes worse. You've got to flee.
I'd like to return to something you said earlier, Craig. And when you mentioned that, I don't know if you use the term fear, that men have had because of the changing roles. And I'd like to know how you describe that fear or what that is. And this is an honest question.
think is that kind of an honest answer. I think that the very changing of the questions about roles, the questioning of the role definition, and the questioning of the place of women in our society was confusing to everyone. I think for many men, maybe all men, it forced us to look at the attitudes and the assumptions that we grew up with, that we had. And that's a painful process. I mean, you know, change is always painful, and it can be frightening, it can be intimidating, and you can compensate that by denying that there's a problem, by bullying, by declaring that it's a problem that you will not be intimidated by, or by going through the process of saying, I want to respond to this, I hear this and I want to respond. And I think that fear still exists. I'm not saying it's gone away, but I'm saying I think that for many men it's less of a problem than it was a generation ago.
Can you name some of the specific kinds of behavior and manifestations of that?
Of fear?
Well, that particular fear.
Help me, guys.
Anger.
Yeah, I think
anger. Irritation.
I would respond to it, I think, in a general way. And the word has been used, I think, maybe 15, 20 times tonight. But it's not at all clear to me what it means. And that's equality. Equality in what way? Equality economically? There are certain ways that we're never going to be equal. I can never have a child. So what do you mean? I think that's part of the confusion. And so I guess I would like some response on that.
There's also probably a good deal of just gut level feelings of being threatened, right? I mean, all of the power that we were used to having, we don't have anymore. And it's up for grabs. And that's real threatening, and I think fear producing on the parts of virtually every male in the culture.
Any of us who have been in a privileged position feel threatened when we're in privilege and looks like it's going to be taken away.
I think every oppressor is inherently and intrinsically afraid. Mm-hmm. And because they have to hold on to that position, we have to hold on to that position with the constant use of power.
Look at the whites in South Africa now.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sprang in mind.
Mm-hmm. And in the South, you know, you look at the films of Martin Luther King and the marches and so on. I mean, those people were deathly afraid. And the calm that King had was one of absence of fear, and I think that's one of the reasons that his movement was able to spread, is because they knew they had only to gain, and they had to overcome fear.
I think fear, though, is a very normal human emotion. I don't know who somebody said, if you're not afraid, you're a fool. We all have fear. The question is if we let that fear be the barrier or step beyond that. Mm-hmm. And women have a lot of fear about, it's one thing to know there's things out there and things you need to be exploring, and there's something very attractive about that. There's also fear, just knowledge of the backlash that comes with that, the knowledge that it's going to be difficult, and is the difficulty worth it? You know, you get pulled in lots of different directions, and this is one reason women have always been together, supporting each other, because otherwise we never would have made it this far. But I think that fear is not just a male phenomenon. Women share that fear, but it's a question of how we deal with it. Mm-hmm. Important to everybody.
I know that perhaps 3 or 4 years ago in my city, Baltimore, there was a survey of high school students, and over 50% of the young women didn't believe that they'd have to work for a living, that they'd have to support themselves. Still, they didn't believe that. That is very frightening, that they still have that idea. And someone was in the village was talking to me today about the young women, the teenage women, who come to Holden Village, many of whom seem as if their main interest, or perhaps their only interest, is to gain approval of the men, because I think that there is still that attitude that a woman isn't complete unless she has the attention of a man, and many of us have been told that, and it's still around. And I'm very dismayed by the number of college-age women, of college-bound women, who
would never call themselves feminists because somehow it means that they're not attractive to men.
You know, on a different point of view, from a man's perspective, there are burdens that have been placed on men, and there's, in a sense, the liberation that has occurred, the woman liberation, is a liberation for men also. One of the things that I've seen time and time again that has bothered me about what I see men doing is the small amount of time that they spend with their families, and their children in particular. And when I was a graduate student, I had the opportunity, because of the kind of work I was doing, to spend a lot of time with my children, and it meant a great deal to me when they were young. So you have, if you think about the kind of way our society is structured, it makes it very difficult for males to participate with their, you know, in a meaningful way with their family a lot of times, except in the evenings when they're tired. So in that sense, there is a liberation that's occurring for men in that area. And the other area that relates just to what you were talking about, our society has always placed the burden of the provider, in the past anyway, being the male. So the male, you probably won't have any young man out there saying, well, I'm not going to have a job, my wife is going to support me. Now that might happen now, but it certainly would have never happened 10 years ago. And so that has always been a burden, in a sense, although it always has put us in a position of power, although I'm not sure of that either. And so I think there's a liberation that's occurring in that area.
But the many women that I've worked with work full-time, and their husbands allow them, is the way that some of them put it, to work full-time as long as they have dinner on the table and the kids taken care of so that they won't be a problem. And that doesn't strike me as liberation. This is not just an American issue. This is happening in the Soviet Union, where men and women work full days. Oh, how liberating, except that the women have to stand in the long, long lines to get food for the families and cook it, and their husbands sit in front of the TV sets. None of that seems like men and women are both affected, but I don't think it's fair to say men and women are both oppressed.
John, did you want
to? He's just getting up in arms because he does all the house cleaning. I'm a slob.
That's changed a lot. Yeah, it's changed a lot. We share those duties, and we're not the only ones. I mean, I'm no exemplar of male virtue, but I mean, there has been a lot of expectation. I know that, for example, I left early with the kids and came home to Carol's parents in Wisconsin, and I like Carol's dad a lot. He's a great guy. But there was a clear difference in the role that I played and the role that he was used to playing. It wasn't like he was trying to be chauvinist, he was just comfortable. You know, this is his home, he was born in the house, and he wasn't about to change. And I wonder if we know how far we've come sometimes, and how much we've changed, and how much the man has been liberated along with the woman. I know that seems frustrating to a lot of people.
I've seen situations where mother and dad, when they had a couple of tiny ones, would agree to both go part-time. These were a couple of nurses I worked with. And they just had a real good thing going there because they could both enjoy their children and work with them when they were little. Then the other thing we saw this happened to be in pediatric nursing, I'd say the last 5-10 years, much, much more interest and active participation by the fathers. Some of them were better with the kids than the mothers, particularly like kids on respirators and all. And they just spent hour after hour and were excellent with them. The doctors, too, you could see a difference in the last several years in the way they, sure, they took care of the kids before, but they seemed to realize more that this was a little one, and they realized how they were developing and the concerns about their personality and all. It was really great.
Tony and I share a job. When we had babies, we cut back from 2 full-time jobs to 1 and divided the 1 job and went on that way for many years when our children were small. And it was interesting in many ways. One way was the public reacted to me that it was okay, and knowing Ingrid, she would work and stuff. It was okay that I went to work half-time. But the assumption was that I would be home, and on my part too, I wanted to be home. I loved having babies. But he, choosing to go half-time at work and to turn down some nice sort of plummy things that he could have done for his career on the grounds that he was doing childcare, and was treated more negatively. You know, it wasn't okay for him to cut his career back and do less public work and do more work at home. And also, we got some grief for deciding to live on 1 income instead of 2. Mm-hmm.
But it sure was wonderful. I mean, there was absolutely no way that I would choose to do anything but that. The gifts of those years and continuing